And welcome to The Morning Magazine, your Front Range morning news program here on Community Radio KGNU. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Hanley Myers, in for Maeve Conran. Coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about low vaccination rates for children in Colorado. Colorado ranks well below the national average in terms of kindergarten-aged children being vaccinated for measles, mumps, and whooping cough. Then Leland Rucker brings us the latest cannabis news, followed by a look at what's happening with food on Radio Nibbles with John Lindorf, who'll be joining us live in the studio. After BBC headlines at 8:30, Tish Buford is back in the studio this morning, taking a look at homelessness in Denver and the Right to Survive ballot initiative that Denver voters will decide on this May. At 9 o'clock, it's the latest edition of the Radio Book Club with Colorado author Mark Mayer talking about his latest collection of short stories, The Aerialists. But first, at 5 minutes past 8 o'clock, it's time for your local headlines. The U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Water and Power heard testimony Wednesday on the Colorado River Drought Contingency Plan. The DCP deal leaves water in Lakes Mead and Powell to boost the Colorado River system. Water levels in those reservoirs have dropped in recent years. Arizona Senator Martha McSally asked John Ensminger of Southern Nevada Water Authority why he wants legislation passed soon.
There are some immediate, if we don't get it done by the end of April, then we're going to have missed opportunities specifically related to Mexico. Is that what you said, Mr. Ensminger?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
McSally said bipartisan legislation would be introduced in Congress, quote, very soon. Water officials from across the southwestern watershed go before a House subcommittee today. Yesterday, a federal judge ruled that BLM and U.S. Forest Service illegally approved fracking operations in western Colorado. With more, here's Rod Brewski.
Lewis Babcock, federal judge, ruled that the two federal agencies failed to account for potential harm to wildlife and watershed impacts. The proposed large-scale Bull Mountain project is located in the headwaters of the North Fork of the Gunnison River, providing drinking irrigation water for the Front Range and Western Slope users. For KGNU, I'm Rod Brewski.
The Denver City Council voted unanimously on Tuesday night to remove a local sales tax on feminine products sold within the city. The tampon tax bill will get rid of the city's 4.3% tax on products like tampons and pads. Consumers will still be required to pay state taxes on feminine hygiene products. Tuesday's decision also reclassifies those feminine products as medically necessary. The bill will take effect on July 1st, 2019. Expect a high today around 67 degrees, low tonight somewhere around 30. We do see a chance for showers this evening that could turn into snow on Friday and last into early Saturday, dropping highs into the 40s for a few days before things warm back up early next week. It's currently around 37 degrees on the Front Range. Less than 89% of the state's kindergarten-age children have been vaccinated for illnesses such as measles, mumps, whooping cough, and chickenpox. That's far below the national median and the 95% threshold needed to prevent an outbreak. The low rates of vaccination prompted Denver Public Health to issue a warning in January about measles exposure. And in February, state officials started to investigate multiple reports of mumps infections. KGNU's Carl Armin spoke with Dr. Jessica Cataldi, a pediatrician at Children's Hospital Colorado and assistant professor of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Dr. Cataldi and Carl Armin, who conducted the interview, co-authored a recent report, Vaccine-Preventable Diseases in Colorado's Children.
There is a problem with Colorado children not being as protected with vaccines as we would like them to be. So we recently released a report called the Vaccine Preventable Disease Report, where we looked at all of the children in the state of Colorado in 2017 and where we're at with their vaccination rates. And what we see is that, unfortunately, for young children, so children in the first 2 years of life, only 71% of them have gotten all of the recommended vaccines by the time that they're recommended. That's not great, and it puts Colorado at 23rd in the nation, which is down from a few years ago when we were actually 10th in the nation for vaccination rates in those young kids. So we know that 29% of kids in those first 2 years of life really aren't protected by all the vaccines that they could be. And what we see as a result of that, unfortunately, is children being hospitalized and seen in the emergency department for diseases that could have been prevented. What we saw there in 2017 is over 9,000 Colorado children were seen in the hospital or in an emergency room for one of these infections, like bad pneumonia or sepsis with an infection that could be protected by a vaccine or could have been prevented. Saw a lot of hospitalization and emergency room visits for influenza, which can also be prevented with vaccination, and also things like varicella or chickenpox.
You mentioned sepsis and pneumonia, but those aren't viral infections or vaccine-preventable diseases. So why do children end up in the hospital with those conditions which aren't specifically a vaccine-preventable disease?
Sure. So that's a great point that you picked up on there. So there are a couple specific bacteria. One is called Strep pneumoniae, which is the bacteria that causes bad pneumonia in children and also adults. It can also cause ear infections. And if that bacteria gets into the blood, can cause sepsis, make you very sick. It can also cause meningitis. So we have a vaccine that can prevent most of those infections. And unfortunately, we have seen children hospitalized for infections with that bacteria. Also, there's a bacteria called Haemophilus influenza, which is not the same as the influenza virus or the flu. It's actually a bacteria, and we have a very good vaccine to protect against that bacteria. Back before we had that vaccine for Haemophilus influenza B, we saw so many children hospitalized with bloodstream infections or sepsis with that bacteria and with horrible meningitis. So we're very thankful to have that vaccine and want all children to get the protection that it offers. We did see in Boulder County, children from that county were hospitalized for vaccine-preventable illnesses, and the costs of those hospitalizations just for children in Boulder County were over $1 million for the hospitalizations, and then also over $1 million for emergency room visits, many related to influenza, but also some for pertussis and some for varicella or chickenpox. So we know that this is a problem. We also know that vaccination rates in Boulder County are not as high as we would like them to be for these early childhood vaccines. And so when we see these hospitalizations and emergency room visits, we worry that they could have been prevented by keeping higher vaccination rates and really making sure that all children are protected. For influenza, it's a challenge because we know that the flu vaccine isn't perfect, but our influenza vaccination rates are also among the lowest compared to the other childhood vaccines. So getting an influenza vaccine, even in a year where it's not offering 100% protection, it still helps to make those influenza infections less severe when they do happen and to keep people out of the hospital and out of the emergency room.
What do you think are the barriers to people getting their children vaccinated?
I think there's a lot of different barriers. I mean, it's different in different places, and it can be different for different families. We know across Colorado, there are places where people still struggle with getting access to healthcare and access to vaccines. And that may be more of an issue in the western part of the state or in more rural areas, even in the northeastern corner of the state. But we also struggle with the issue of people who can access the healthcare that they need for their children and are able to see a provider for vaccines, but choose not to get vaccines or have concerns and choose to delay vaccination. So some of that, I think, comes from every parent's normal worry that they want to do what's best for their child, and they see vaccines as maybe a confusing or overwhelming topic. There's been some things in the news lately about information on social media that is misleading and some more attention drawn to the fact that these concerns about vaccines are often promoted in a way that doesn't share the science of how safe vaccines are and how important they are to protect from these dangerous diseases. So I think many parents are just looking for answers and looking to do the right things for their children and can often be misled by things that they read or that they hear around the community from friends.
Well, let's talk about some of the facts regarding these vaccine-preventable diseases and how they made life very difficult for children before there were vaccines. Because again, maybe the one other problem is that we have such a success with vaccines that people have not experienced these diseases in their children's lives or maybe even in their own lives when they were younger. So could you elaborate on the various vaccine-preventable diseases and what they can do without people being protected by the vaccines?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that idea that, you know, we're victims of our own success with vaccines here certainly rings true. I'll start with measles because that's been in the news a lot lately. Measles is an infection that caused by a virus, and the symptoms can start with a fever, rash, cough, or runny nose. But the concerning part is that this can, in some cases, become much more severe and cause bad pneumonia where people need to be hospitalized for help with oxygen and help breathing, and can also cause inflammation of the brain or encephalitis, often leading to hospitalization. And we know that even today, still over 200,000 people a year get sick with measles in developing countries, and some of those people die. In the U.S., what we've seen lately is sort of a resurgence of measles outbreaks, and several of these have happened in areas or in groups of people who have low vaccination rates. So there's an outbreak going on right now in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State. I had a couple of cases there in Oregon as well. And right now there's over 60 people who have been sick with measles there. There were several cases earlier this year in the Houston area, another area with low vaccination rates. And then there's an ongoing outbreak in New York State that's been going on since last fall, again, in a population of people who have low vaccination rates.
I can imagine somebody saying, well, I had measles as a kid and it was no big deal. You had a fever, a rash, and you got over it. So why is there being such a big deal made about measles? Obviously, this disease can be much more serious than what we may have experienced as children pre-vaccination. Could you talk about that?
That's right. You know, many people get measles and get over it. But even those people who don't have severe disease probably stayed home from school. That might keep a parent home from work. So those infections aren't good either. The trouble we see is that in patients who get more sick with things like inflammation of the brain or bad pneumonia, those cases can sometimes lead to death. And the other problem is some people are more vulnerable to infection. So pregnant women are vulnerable to having complications in their pregnancy or becoming more sick if they become infected with measles. And then people with weakened immune systems, so very young babies, older adults, and also people who have some compromise of their immune system, either due to being on medication or having cancer and being on chemotherapy, they're much more vulnerable to becoming severely ill with an infection like measles.
Dr. Jessica Cataldi, a pediatrician at Children's Hospital Colorado and assistant professor of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Dr. Cataldi and KGNU's Carl Armin, who conducted the interview, co-authored a recent report, Vaccine-Preventable Diseases in Colorado's Children. We'll put an extended interview with them online at news.kgnu.org. Colorado ranks well below the national average in terms of children's vaccinations. Less than 89 of the state's kindergarten-age children have received vaccines for measles, mumps, whooping cough, and chicken pox. The national average is 95%.
Leland Rucker is the senior editor at Sensi Magazine, and he joins us on Thursday mornings to talk about the latest news in cannabis. We're going to get into what's happening locally with efforts to expunge folks in Colorado who have on their records low-level crimes pertaining to cannabis that happened prior to Amendment 64. A couple of events happening this weekend. But first, we're going to take a look at what's happening in Michigan. And this is about THC limits for drivers, an issue I know that they've been grappling with here in Colorado.
Yeah, it's something that we've been thinking a lot about here in Colorado. Nobody's really come up with anything to deal with this. We've talked about impaired driving. You know, we can't determine whether the amount of THC in someone's system means that they are impaired. There's no way to determine this. We've done this with alcohol to a pretty good extent, but we've not been able to do that. And so states like Colorado have come up with their own laws concerning this. For instance, we have a system that if your blood tests at 5 nanograms per milliliter of blood or higher, you're considered impaired, although you can argue in court if you're arrested on that, that you weren't impaired because they have a lot of medical patients and people like that. Washington and Montana have the same 5 mg limits. Nevada and Ohio are lower at 2, and Pennsylvania is 1. They're the only states that have actually set limits. This week in Michigan, a 6-member panel that was mandated by state law to research and recommend a THC threshold actually recommended that the state not set a THC limit. And the reason that they did this is because they found no scientifically supported threshold of THC bodily content that would be indicative of impaired driving, which is exactly what we've been saying all along about the problems here. And there's a poor correlation between driving impairment and the blood levels of THC at the time of blood collection. And this is because THC levels drop rapidly after you use it, and yet impairment happens more slowly. And this is, again, this is some of the problems we've had to deal with, but this is the first state to actually say, let's not have those kind of limits. And what they are saying then is we'll have to go back to other ways of determining impairment. One of those, of course, is field sobriety tests. And as we've talked about on the show, I did those field sobriety tests. And a lot of people, me included, can't do those tests sober. So that's not a very good indicator of THC levels either. It means that police will just have to go back to looking at the situation, to looking at how people are, to looking at the speed and what was actually happening. And I think that's a positive step. Not having those THC levels, because I think a lot of the THC levels have been created just to make people feel better. Because there's millions of Americans out there who are driving on cannabis. We can't imagine that just because a state is illegal that people aren't driving on cannabis. It's not going to be a major change.
Well, in another state, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy had a pretty significant defeat this week.
Yeah, this is interesting. New Jersey's as blue as they come, and everybody thought that the legislature was going to pass this. And earlier this week, Governor Phil Murphy canceled the scheduled vote on legislation. He said he just underestimated the challenge of getting it passed and said he just didn't have enough votes.
So he had been pushing to have a statewide vote on whether or not to legalize cannabis. And at the last minute, he says, I'm not sure we're going to get the vote, so let's cancel it.
Exactly.
Well, here in Colorado, obviously a state that has legalized cannabis, there are now efforts to tackle people who have low-level cannabis-related crimes on their record that they incurred prior to Amendment 64. And I know the Denver Justice Center this Saturday will host a workshop for people to find out how to get that done. Boulder is also hosting workshops as well. This really is an opportunity for people to have those records expunged, which can have a lifelong implication if you have this on your record.
Yeah, that's for sure. This is something that's very important. And I just read a story that said that not many people have taken advantage of this so far. In Boulder and Denver, both are offering this. And I think that anyone that you might know, or if you are a person who has a criminal record because of marijuana, should definitely get a hold of these things. These are very important. Another thing to remember is that this weekend is the NoCo Hemp Festival, the largest hemp festival in the world. This year, they're expecting 10,000 people. That's going to be unbelievable.
Well, we're going to hear about that on Friday's Morning Magazine, because as you said, it's the largest hemp festival or hemp event. It's really a business expo, and there will be people there talking about regulation and education and various different things. It is called NoCo because Northern Colorado, but this year they're actually moving it to Denver because they needed a bigger space. So that is an indication of how big this is happening, particularly in the light of the 2018 Farm Bill, which essentially lifted federal regulations on hemp. So tune in to Friday's Morning Magazine, hear more about that. But of course, you can read more about what's happening in cannabis at sensimag.com. Catch the hard copy at newsstands around the Front Range. And Leland Rucker joins us Thursday mornings. Thanks, Leland.
Thank you.
Have a banana.
And that theme music means that we are ready to start here with John Lindorf in the studio. It's time for Radio Nibbles. We do have John here. You want to talk about books this morning, specifically wants to open up a little library in Boulder, a little library dedicated to books about food. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first I have to say, until this moment, you know, we've had that theme song for dozens of years, and until this moment I didn't think about the first line, have a banana, Hannah. That aside, yes, I've had a dream. I think everyone knows what a little library is. You see them around town in neighborhoods, and I love them. It's people sharing books, and you take a book and bring it back, or you pass it on to someone else. And I had this vision of there being a little cookbook library. And the reason is that, take myself for example. I mean, I really should have done this 3 or 4 years ago before I moved a couple of times, but I had easily 500 or 600 cookbooks collected from my career. Gradually, those have migrated other places. I still have a lot of them. They're sitting in boxes. People should be cooking with them. And, you know, there's a lot of People have dozens of these cookbooks sitting around, and when you decide that you want to divest yourself of them, you know what happens? No one wants them. You know, they end up in trash or recycling.
Oh, and I always would love to have one with notes in it.
That's exactly what I was thinking, you know. What I like is when you open a cookbook, like a family recipe, and there's notes on it that says, don't use this much flour, or I did this. I would love to see cookbooks in this, which I'm, you know, I've decided to call this John's Big Little Free Cookbook Library. And we hope to, I hope we can do it at KGNU, because it's a community gathering place. And I'd love to have a place where cooks can come and help themselves cook better.
Yeah, and I would say that there are many of us who could absolutely use some pointers from those of you that have annotated cookbooks out there. Anyone with an annotated cookbook probably has a lot to share for lots of us. So, yeah, what kind of books would you specifically think would be the most valuable to?
Well, I grabbed two of the newer ones off my shelf that I would put on the shelf right now. One of them is called Microbia, and it's by Eugenia Bone. She lives in the Western Slope. She's a wonderful writer. She writes about the unseen world of microbes. For anyone who is interested in kombucha or beer or probiotic hot sauce or whatever, this is the background to that, and that would be interesting to them. I also have another wonderful book called Meathead, and it is deep into the science of grilling. I also have books on pastry making and cookies. I have community cookbooks that, you know. What I'm saying is there's this vast quantity of knowledge out there. I wish there was a way to bring it together. And so I'm sort of inviting comment. You can, if you think this is an interesting idea and maybe want to help me realize it, doesn't it seem like the little libraries tend to look really cute, you know, and this one I think should look like a refrigerator or a stove.
And what's the best way to get in touch with you while we're on that?
To nibbles@boulderweekly.com.
So definitely send in your insight on a little cookbook library. John, what's the best thing that you've tasted lately?
Oh, my God. I went to this place called Julep in Denver. It's on Larimer. And it's run by folks from the South. And I went to brunch and had easily the best fried chicken I've had in a decade, and I highly recommend it. The waffles, the sorghum syrup, the biscuits, the whole thing.
And as far as I was telling you in advance that I'm new to the chicken and waffles being a fried chicken element here, and so it sounds like it's a big deal for you to say that it's the best chicken or fried chicken that you've had recently. I've found that there's a world of different types there.
Yeah, no, it's mostly, it's like with a lot of things. You have to cook the chicken long enough, and you can't eat here at Julep unless you're patient.
And do you like I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the spicy fried chicken when you add that mixture into?
It's like anything else. If you, I feel like if it's great chicken, and you cook it properly, you don't want to season it to the point that you can't taste the chicken. And some of those hot chickens are just too hot, which is okay for lousy chicken, but, you know.
And selfishly, I have to ask now, what are some other locations that you would say are hot spots for fried chicken, that for those of us who are maybe new enthusiasts or longtime enthusiasts?
That's all I can recommend at the moment, because that's the first that's... I've had that I thought was tremendous in a long time.
And we always enjoy having you here. So, ladies and gentlemen, remember that if you are interested in this idea of the little cookbook here at KGNU, make sure to reach out to John. And again, is that Nibbles was the best way?
Right. And somebody's got to build this thing. So, you know.
It's true. So always looking for insight. And that's a great, at KGNU, we do have both, I feel like, a lot of people that could bring those cookbooks and also other people that could maybe build for us. So you can read John's Nibbles column in the Boulder Weekly and his Taste Buds column on CBD in Food in Cincy Magazine, and listen to archive radio Nibble shows at news.kgnu.org.
Most important news of the day. There are only 9 cooking days until the Boulder County Farmers Market opens in Boulder and Longmont.
And thanks. Always a pleasure to have John in. Now we go right into the BBC.
One of Sweden's biggest banks, Swedbank, has dismissed its chief executive amid investigations into allegations that it was involved in laundering billions of dollars of mainly Russian money. Sweden's financial investigators raided Swedbank on Wednesday. Several other Nordic lenders have already been caught up in the scandal. There has been another deadly explosion in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Ambulance workers say at least 11 people were killed and 16 injured when the car bomb went off in a busy area near hotels, restaurants and businesses. It's the latest in a wave of explosions blamed on the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. The campaign group Human Rights Watch says Kenya should abandon renewed plans to shut the vast Dadaab refugee camp, which houses about 250,000 Somalis. The group argues they would face violence and persecution if they were sent back to Somalia. The Turkish lira has fallen sharply, losing almost 6% of its value in trading on Thursday. The currency has been under pressure over concerns about Turkey's foreign exchange reserves. But President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has blamed the falls on what he called a plot by the United States. At least 16 people have died in a fire in a high-rise office block in Bangladesh. A number of victims fell to their deaths as they tried to escape the blaze. There are reports of gunfire near the main military base in the Comoros following the arrest of one of the defeated candidates in Sunday's presidential election. There have been claims the vote was rigged. BBC News.